I'm John Strum, and this is Real Talk MS. It's March 2nd, and we have a lot to talk about. If you happen to miss it, this past weekend we released a bonus episode of Real Talk MS with highlights from the ACTRIMS Forum 2021. The Americas Committee for Treatment and Research in Multiple Sclerosis convened their annual conference last week, and our bonus episode features my exclusive interview with this year's recipient of the Baranczyk Prize for Innovation in MS Research, Dr. Dwight Burgles. If you're at all interested in remyelination, most, if not all, of the remyelination research being done today is based upon Dr. Burgles' foundational discoveries. So if you haven't already, I hope you find time to listen. And you can find that bonus episode at realtalkms.com, Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, Spotify, Amazon Music, and all the usual suspects. I also want to give a quick shout out to more than 500 of you who've already taken our first ever Real Talk MS listener survey. By completing the survey, you're giving me an opportunity to learn a little bit more about the Real Talk MS listener community, and you're giving yourself an opportunity to win a $100 Amazon gift card. So if you haven't had a chance to take the survey, it's pretty quick. It'll take you less than 7 minutes to complete, and it would mean a lot to me if you could do me that favor. You'll find the survey at realtalkms.com/survey. I've long considered MS to be an equal opportunity disease. It impacts people of all ages, sexual orientations, and ethnic backgrounds. But over the past year, I've seen enough evidence to understand that once you drill down and look at things like having access to quality MS care, and even looking at the course of the disease itself, well, I realize I was wrong. One more reality of MS is that it impacts members of minority populations differently. Check that. It impacts members of minority populations worse. Joining me to discuss some of the disparities that affect members of minority populations who are living with MS is a returning guest and friend of the podcast, Dr. Mitzi Joy Williams. Dr. Williams is a board-certified neurologist and multiple sclerosis specialist who's passionate about educating and empowering people affected by MS to understand the disease process and the goals of treatment. She collaborates regularly with national and international committees to advocate for people living with MS, and Dr. Williams is an expert in understanding MS in underserved and minority populations. But before we get to my conversation with Dr. Mitzi Joy Williams, there are a few other things that you should know about. One of the goals of the International Progressive MS Alliance is to shorten clinical trials. Believe it or not, it takes about 10 years to bring a drug from discovery all the way through regulatory approval. And by anyone's measure, that's just too long. Especially when you begin to consider how advances in technology present opportunities to make clinical trials more efficient. And a working group from the Progressive MS Alliance has published a paper in Nature Review Neurology recommending changes in the way that clinical trials are designed and conducted. The paper recommends testing multiple medicines at the same time, using advanced trial designs, testing new therapies in combination with an approved MS therapy to reduce the potential interference of inflammation on trial results, and using diverse measures of disease biology on top of a core set of outcome measures to track an experimental medicine's effects. Now, these core measures include clinical measures like upper limb dexterity to track disability. They could also include testing of mobility, vision, cognition, or other measures that may be appropriate to a given participant population. Core measures should also include things like imaging or blood biomarkers to measure disease activity, tests of biological response indicators related to mechanism of action, and exploratory measures such as gene transcriptomics. The working group also recommended using less restrictive criteria for characteristics of people to be included in the trial, using alternative clinical trial designs, and soliciting feedback on the feasibility of trial designs from people living with MS. Now, another aspect of this paper is focused on a proposed research funding program to be supported by the Alliance. This new program would provide grants for Phase 2 experimental medicine trials that explore treatments and targets while generating hypotheses about disease mechanisms, using biological and clinical measures that align with those proposed in the Alliance's paper. To put all that in more basic terms, the Alliance believes that making these proposed changes in clinical trial design and execution will accelerate our understanding of underlying disease mechanisms. And they're willing to put their money where their expert opinion is by funding research that aligns with these proposed changes. Prior to launching their request for applications, the Alliance is soliciting feedback on these new recommendations from the scientific community. And if you'd like to review the Alliance's recommendations, you'll find a link in today's show notes. You don't have to be affected by MS to know that the abuse of opioids is a serious problem. In fact, the use, abuse, and overprescribing of opioid drugs has been declared a public health emergency in the United States. As a result, it's hard to find instances where opioids are still being prescribed for managing chronic pain. Now, there isn't much in the way of research on the use of opioids to manage MS-related chronic pain. The only published study on opioid use among people living with MS found that about 38% of those people with MS-related pain were currently using opioids. But one of the poster presentations at last week's ACTRIMS forum served as a reminder that we need to pay attention to opioid abuse in the MS community. A research team from the VA Portland Healthcare System analyzed patient information from a multi-site MS fatigue management study that was conducted in the United States in 2013 and 2014. 282 people with MS were screened to participate in this study, and the screening process required them to self-report all of the prescription and over-the-counter medications that they were taking. 21% of the participants reported using prescription opioids, and of those participants using opioids, 76% reported regular daily use. The sad reality here is that opioid use rarely ends well. And if 1 in 5 people living with MS-related pain are using prescription opioids, we have a problem that needs attention and response. The research team concluded that, and I'll quote now, "This high level of opioid use supports that better pain management treatment options, including non-pharmacologic options, are needed for people with multiple sclerosis and pain." I'll just add, the sooner, the better. And if you'd like to review these research results, you'll find the link in today's show notes. Evidence shows that music therapy provides benefits for both physical and mental function among people with central nervous system diseases like MS. So you'll often find music therapy as part of a comprehensive MS management plan. And now you can gain the benefit of music therapy without having to leave home. Bristol-Myers Squibb and the American Music Therapy Association are partnering with singer and actor Ben Platt and his sister-in-law, dancer, choreographer, and actor Courtney Platt, to launch MS in Harmony, the first digital music therapy for people living with MS. You may know Ben Platt from his Tony Award-winning performance starring in Dear Evan Hansen on Broadway, or the films Pitch Perfect and Pitch Perfect 2, or the Netflix series The Politician, for which he was nominated for a Golden Globe Award for Best Actor in a Television Series, Musical, or Comedy. Ben's sister-in-law, Courtney, lives with relapsing remitting MS, and she's leading an MS in Harmony challenge on Instagram. The MS in Harmony program has launched a website where patients and care partners can learn more about music therapy and explore interactive music therapy exercises. You'll find that website at msinharmony.com, and you'll also find a link to msinharmony.com in today's show notes. While we're talking about resources you can access and engage with from home, I want to tell you about some of the upcoming programs that CanDo MS is offering this month. Now, tomorrow, that's March 3rd at 8 p.m. Eastern Time, you can catch their webinar on staying resilient to MS transitions. Saturday, March 13th at 1 p.m. Eastern Time, you can participate in their Jumpstart program titled Embracing Transitions in Your Life. On March 17th at 11 a.m. Eastern Time, you can connect with a group of people in a coaching session titled Finding Your New You, Redefining Yourself During Times of Transition. On March 25th at 3 p.m. Eastern Time, there's a Jumpstart program titled Bouncing Back and Moving Forward. And on March 30th at 6 p.m. Eastern Time, there's another coaching session, this one on Building Resilience to Overcome Setbacks. That's a great month of programs designed to help you build your resilience. And I think that between dealing with all of the changes in our lives due to the pandemic, the anxiety around waiting to receive your COVID-19 vaccine, and just living with MS, you may find resilience to be in short supply. All of the CanDo MS programs are available to you at no charge, and you can participate from the comfort and safety of your own home. If you'd like to learn more and sign up for these upcoming workshops and coaching sessions, you'll find a link in today's show notes. Speaking of resilience, imagine that one day you begin experiencing physical symptoms that you can't understand. You develop a vision problem for a few days, or you wake up with this feeling like pins and needles in your arm, or your leg just feels numb. So you visit your doctor and he or she can't figure out what your problem is. And after spending time Googling your symptoms, you think that, well, this could be MS. But when you share that information with your doctor dismisses it, explaining that people like you don't get MS. And so it takes you years to finally be diagnosed with multiple sclerosis. Years that you weren't on any disease-modifying therapy that could actually slow MS progression. How much resilience would you need just to get through being diagnosed? And how would it feel to be told that, gee, people like you don't get MS? Well, believe it or not, this still happens too often to Black people who develop MS and then visit doctors who, despite all the evidence to the contrary, still believe that MS is a white woman's disease. Unfortunately, for members of the Black, Hispanic, and Latinx communities, living with MS carries with it additional barriers to treatment and additional physical aspects of the disease itself. My guest today is Dr. Mitzi Joy Williams, and we're talking about some of the disparities that confront members of minority populations who are living with MS. In a moment, we'll meet my guest, Dr. Mitzi Joy Williams. Looking at the nearly 1 million people who are living with MS in the United States, you might conclude that MS doesn't discriminate. After all, it impacts people of all ages, all sexual orientations, all ethnic backgrounds. However, when you drill down a bit further and look at things like having access to quality care, and even looking at the course of the disease itself, well, that statement starts appearing less true. My guest today is Dr. Mitzi Joy Williams, and we're talking about some of the disparities that impact members of minority populations who are living with MS. Dr. Williams is a board-certified neurologist and multiple sclerosis specialist who's passionate about educating and empowering people affected by MS to understand the disease process and the goals of treatment. Dr. Williams is a sought-after consultant, speaker, researcher, and author, and she's an expert in understanding MS in underserved and minority populations. Dr. Williams collaborates with national and international committees to advocate for people living with MS, and she's dedicated to raising awareness about the importance of research participation and encouraging diversity in clinical research. Well, welcome back to the podcast, Dr. Williams.
Thank you so much for having me, John. It's my pleasure.
When I think about the various disparities that affect members of minority populations who are living with MS, I see them falling into one of two categories. There are the disparate aspects of the disease course itself, the way that MS impacts members of minority communities differently. And then there are the systemic or institutional inequities that create extra and significant burden for members of minority communities. So let's talk about those disease-related disparities first. Are there some clinical characteristics of MS that are different in Black, Hispanic, or Latinx people?
Absolutely. So some of the differences that we see are mostly affected when we're talking about outcomes. So we see more disability in both of these populations over time. For Black people, we see a faster progression from relapsing MS to secondary progressive MS. We also see more motor dysfunction or walking disability, where Black people can have to use a cane or walker to walk up to 6 to 10 years earlier than their white counterparts. So when we look at other measures such as visual dysfunction, we see worse visual problems as well as more lesions on MRI. So across the board, we see potentially worse outcomes in both of these groups.
Is the proportion of MS subtypes like relapsing or progressive MS, are they also different in minority groups?
So the proportion of subtypes seems to be similar. However, there is a faster progression from relapsing to secondary progressive MS in the Black population. But overall, it doesn't appear that Black or Hispanic Latinx communities have more progressive disease from the start. The subtypes are very similar in that regard.
And what about the onset of MS? Are there differences in age among members of minority populations when it comes to the initial onset of MS?
Absolutely. So the age in Hispanic Latinx communities is slightly younger, so mid-30s or so. And then the age in the African-American community, there's some reports that say it's slightly older, a couple of years older than their white counterparts versus some studies say a little bit younger. But there's several that say the age is a little bit older in the Black population.
So when onset is seen as a couple of years later, as people are a little older when they're diagnosed with MS, do you think that's a function of barriers to diagnosis, or is it disease behavior itself?
That's a great question. And it certainly could be delay to diagnosis because many people who actually are eventually diagnosed with MS often report symptoms in their teenage years. And for African Americans, because of some of those health barriers and institutional barriers, including systemic racism as well as bias within the medical system, MS may not be thought of as a possible diagnosis for people presenting with clear symptoms of MS. So that certainly could delay diagnosis and maybe why they're diagnosed at a later age.
Speaking of presenting with clear symptoms of MS, a foundational aspect of making that diagnosis and then following MS in a patient is an MRI exam. Have any differences been identified in MRI imaging among members of minority populations?
Yes. So often there is a larger burden of disease. So when we think about lesions related to MS, it's not really helpful to count them because two spots could mean two small spots or could mean one huge spot and one small spot or two huge spots. So it's important for us to think about how much of the brain space, how much is being taken up by spots. And that's what we call lesion volume. And so in Black patients, there are higher lesion volumes in the brain. There also is more involvement of the spinal cord, which is what I call expensive real estate, meaning there is a lot of function packed into a really small area. So one spot in the spinal cord can make you not be able to walk, whereas you could get multiple spots in the brain and not have any symptoms related to them.
And what about disease-modifying therapies? Have any DMTs been shown to be more or less effective for members of minority populations?
So we don't really have enough data to tell us. When we talk about our clinical trials, we have very low numbers of minorities who are enrolled in clinical trials. So an average of anywhere from maybe 5 to 8% for Hispanic Latinx communities. There are some studies that suggest up to 16% for Black communities, but the majority of them have about 1 to 2%. So we're talking anywhere from 10 people out of a major clinical trial, which usually has thousands of people, to maybe 30 or 40. And so it's very difficult to make generalizations based on 30 or 40 people. I think that, you know, one of the reasons that we want to push to increase diversity in clinical trials is so that we can better understand if our treatments are effective. From the studies that we do have available, many of which are what we call retrospective, so we take a look backward at a population, it seems like the ones where we do have evidence of larger numbers of African Americans in Hispanic Latinx communities, that the treatment effectiveness is similar across the groups. But we really need clinical trials to answer that question.
And speaking of clinical trials, why do you think minority participation is so underrepresented in clinical trials? And I'll make it a two-part question. How do we fix that?
Yeah. So there are a lot of reasons. And again, I think it's so important to make sure that we talk about enrollment versus participation, because when we say there's a lack of participation, it really puts the onus on the patient, like they are the problem. And although there are patient barriers, such as mistrust of the medical system, you know, there's a long history, especially within the Black community, of unethical studies that have been done in the past and even into the 20th century. And so, you know, mistrust is an issue, as well as access to care. So you have to have access to a site that's running clinical trials. And also, we think about institutional barriers, your doctor has to ask you. So if we think about implicit bias, many providers are not asking people of color to be involved. Also, when we think about institutional barriers, a couple of the major ones are inclusion and exclusion criteria. So the criteria for the studies are so strict and so narrow that if you're a person of color who has comorbidities like diabetes, hypertension, you may be automatically excluded from some of these trials, even if your conditions are well controlled. And then finally, we look at the sites where studies are done. Our industry partners do have a responsibility to be intentional about the places where they choose to do studies and try to reach out to communities that have access to minority populations and also to increase the diversity of our researchers. So some of the ways that we can address that are dealing with those problems, making sure we establish trust, making sure we explain the research process, and making sure that people understand that even though they consent to being in the study, if something happens and they want to come out, they absolutely retain all of their rights to exit a study. On the provider side, we have to train about implicit bias and the importance of asking diverse people to be involved in clinical research. And as our institutions and industry partners, they have to be intentional about the way they design studies so that they can be more inclusive, and also about the places where they seek to do research to make sure that we're including diverse populations of people and diverse investigators who can reach those people.
You know, I think there's a certain irony when you talk about the sites of these clinical studies where research is actually being conducted. It sometimes strikes me as funny that some, not all, but some of the major academic institutions that are sites for clinical trials are actually located in the midst of urban areas, not far from that underserved population, the minority populations that we've been discussing. And yet it seems in their recruitment, we still don't see those populations represented.
Absolutely. And I think the key word is that we have to be intentional. We have to be intentional from the start. You know, when we are creating and designing research, we have to be intentional to say, these are the goals that we're trying to achieve. These are the people that we want to reach, and make sure that that's communicated to all of the communities involved. And again, if we're not getting the results that we need, then let's go to different places to try to get different results.
When we talk about the social determinants of health, what does that mean?
Social determinants of health are really factors that affect health outcomes that don't have to do actually with your physical health. So things like access to certain physicians, how far do you live from medical treatment facilities, Are you, do you have transportation to get to those appointments? Do you have access to technology, especially in this age of telemedicine? If we are trying to do telemedicine to make it more convenient, but you have poor internet access or you don't know how to use the different technologies, we're still not able to reach people. So it's all of those factors that lead that could potentially lead to good or bad health outcomes that don't physically have to do with your physical health.
What about access to care? What are some of the barriers that members of minority populations who are living with MS face when accessing healthcare? And are there any differences in how people with MS from within these communities go about accessing healthcare?
So absolutely. So there are several studies that suggest that minority communities, number one, for general neurologic problems, have less access to a neurologist. But there are also specific studies that suggest that African Americans have less access to a neurologist if they have MS. And so we're talking just a general neurologist. And, you know, of course, there are many great general neurologists who are caring for those who have MS. But we're not even talking about subspecialty care. We're not even talking about a specialty center. So there are people who are being cared for by their primary care physicians, may not have access to certain therapies. And so this is a huge issue. Also, socioeconomic status has a lot to do with access to care. You have to be able to take a day or a half day off of work to go see your doctor. You have to, if you are severely disabled, your family member may have to take a day off to go and take you to see the doctor. You have to pay for parking. So there's so many factors that we think of. So just because you physically can be on a roll at a doctor's office does not necessarily mean that you actually have access to care.
You know, one of my listeners shared with me that it took much longer, years longer, for her to be diagnosed with MS because her doctor, and this was someone who lived in a more rural area, but her doctor still considered MS to be a white woman's disease. This particular scenario occurred a few years ago, but this was not a layperson's understanding of MS. It was a physician's. Does this sort of bias still get in the way of diagnosing MS in minority populations?
Absolutely. So there's a lot of education that needs to be done. I was very fortunate to work with one of our industry partners to create a series of programs or co-create a series of programs focused on MS in the Black community that didn't involve any medications. And so it was very interesting when I would go door to door, so to speak with many of the community neurologists, it was really news to them that the incidence of MS is highest in Black people and that African Americans were at higher risk. And so I think that although this information may be common within the MS specialist community, there's still a lot of work to be done to reach the masses. And the majority of people with MS are being cared for by general neurologists. So it's crucial that we get that information out there so that people can be diagnosed and treated earlier.
Speaking of creating programs, when I introduced you, I forgot to mention that you are launching a new podcast. Why don't you tell us about it and tell us where we can find it?
Absolutely. So I'm launching a new podcast that will be kind of a spinoff of a Facebook Live series that I am doing in conjunction with BlackDoctor.org called Brain Chat with the Nerdy Neurologist. I hope to get to John's status one day. I hope to get to your status. But focused on different topics. So, you know, we'll have scientific topics where I have, you know, certain MS specialists and other specialists talk about things specific to MS. We'll also talk about patient advocacy, things like creating your own space and letting your voice be heard and the importance of, you know, telling your story with MS. So I'm really excited about it. So it's every other Monday. So the next one will be on March 8th on Facebook Live on the BlackDoctor.org Facebook page, as well as their YouTube page. And then the podcast will be on Spotify the following week after the Facebook Live is done.
Well, I can only say that in order to reach my status, you'll have to forget an awful lot about what you know about multiple sclerosis, okay? Well, more seriously, you know, it's difficult to fix something until you can clearly see what the problem really is. And Dr. Mitzi Joy Williams, thank you for all the work you do to shine a bright light on the obstacles and barriers that members of underserved minority populations still have to overcome in order to access quality MS care. I'm hopeful that having these conversations today will make them unnecessary in the future. And I want to thank you for talking with me today.
Absolutely. Always a pleasure, John. Thank you so much for inviting me.
Well, that's going to wrap up this episode of Real Talk MS. Real Talk MS is powered by the National MS Society. And you can share this episode of the podcast by letting your friends or family members know that all they have to do is point their web browser at realtalkms.com/183. You'll find that link in today's show notes, so you can easily copy and paste it right into an email or text. I want to remind you that it would mean a lot to me if you could take just a few minutes and fill out our online listener survey. Completing the survey will take you less than 7 minutes, but it will allow me to learn a little more about the Real Talk MS listener community, and you'll be entered into a drawing for a $100 Amazon gift card. You'll find the survey at realtalkms.com/survey. Walk MS 2021 is coming, and this year, Walk MS will meet you where you are to connect, celebrate, and make a difference like never before. I'll be walking, and I hope you're planning to join me this year. You can learn more and register at walkms.org, and you'll find that link in today's show notes. I'm John Strum. Thanks for listening. Stay safe and make healthy choices.